It's Tuesday, November 28th, 2023. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Last year, 2023, though last fiscal year, we are in the aforementioned 2023, it is a new fiscal year. So I speak of the full year statistics of border encounters. There were 3.2 million encounters at the border or borders. This was about 500,000 more than the year before, and a full 1.25 million more than the year prior to that. We have a bona fide border crisis, and part of the crisis, maybe all of the crisis, is that we refuse to address the crisis, which isn't to say it will be easy. What is easy is to yell and blame other people for the crisis. You know, right now in the world, there is not a country that doesn't either have an immigration problem or an emigration problem. The problem for the countries with citizens emigrating is that they're so oppressive, murderous, or unsafe that they can't afford protections to their citizens. So there are a couple of countries like Canada and New Zealand, though they are setting immigration records, that don't seem so aggrieved about it. Polls of their publics show that in general, they support the fact that their government is embracing immigration. It helps the labor force. But even these countries know that the amounts of resources that need to be or might need to be dedicated to new immigrants are not limitless. Just look at what happened in Ireland. A couple of days ago, a full-on riot broke out in that country after a foreign-born resident of Ireland who had been in the country for 20 years attacked a woman and some children. Dublin burned with literal fire, but also with the rage of white Irish who felt under siege. If you just do, and I did this a second ago, a cursory Google search for immigration news, you get immigration-related high-speed chases lead to more deaths in Texas, report. Texas immigration bill SB 1070 is unconstitutional, experts say. That is one governor's facile attempt to demonize immigrants but not solve the problem. Chicago Sun-Times says repealing Chicago's sanctuary city ordinance would put immigrants at risk. Yes, but it's also irrelevant. The sanctuary city doesn't matter much when the rules of the country, our country, have been changed to allow asylum seekers to seek sanctuary. They are most often denied, but they can stay in the country as they seek it. And INS or ICE agents cannot detain them as they're doing that. In a related headline, they fled climate chaos. Asylum law made decades ago might not help. No, it won't help. These immigrants have a horrible life and are so desperate as to risk it all to come here, but the asylum law is not built to give them all asylum. There are a lot of problems that are characterized by hard choices or entrenched interest that make the choices hard, like, say, eliminating coal. It is quite clear that we have to absolutely move away from coal. It will cause disruptions. If I were broadcasting mainly to a West Virginia audience, I would not so blithely say disruptions. I would talk about how you and your family's lives are going to be different and maybe a little bit worse, and you have to pay the price for this, and hopefully you could get some high-paying jobs in some other sector, though that probably won't be manufacturing. But yeah, there are a lot of hard choices, but the solution might be difficult, but it's pretty obvious. That is not the case with immigration. There is no solution out there. So what do we do? Well, voters rush to blame the incumbent. Now, it's interesting. When Trump was president, immigration did not poll as a huge problem. And I think, I mean, it polled as a problem, but not nearly where it is today. I do not think that was because Trump suppressed levels of immigration. I'm speaking independent of the effects of COVID. I think it seemed to almost every Democrat that Trump was so dangerous when it came to any adjudications of people with a skin tone lighter than his own that it played as a pretty easily discerned racial justice question. So they didn't want to admit to pollsters or themselves that the problem was real. But now that Trump is gone, and now that northern cities are being inundated with immigrants bussed up from the border, and now that there is no boogeyman to blame, even Democrats are saying this is a huge problem. Dissatisfaction with immigration and wanting immigration to decrease went from 20% in the last year before the pandemic to 40% now. I, who am very pro-immigration, also wants immigration to decrease because right now the immigration we have isn't a system of immigration. It's the absence of a system. It's just a motley collection of rule breaking, budget stretching, and perilous dangers for the border crossers. Immigration ranks as the third most serious non-economic problem, according to Gallup pollsters. In fact, in the latest poll, 8% said that it was a problem, and that's down from 13% who said that was a problem 2 months ago. I predict by the time the election comes around, it will be closer to 15 or 20%. We all know what Republicans believe or say they believe. It's very easy. It's a bumper sticker. Enforce the law, which probably means deportation. That's easier said than done. Also, we are enforcing asylum laws, and they don't work. They don't really help anyone. Congressional Democrats over the years have more credibility than the average congressional Republican does on this issue. But now, what do Democrats want? This brings me to David Leonhardt. He wrote a very good aphorism in his book, which we are going to discuss. And that aphorism is the Democrats' message on immigration seems to be, and I can't dispute this, certainly the vast majority of voters think this is the Democrats' policy, and if they have a different one, you tell me what it is. Here's the aphorism. More is better, less is racist. That does seem to be the major thing they say. And that, while it's not as bad a position to be in as to be struggling with violence in Honduras or El Salvador or huddled in a van driven by a coyote across Texas, but that position, politically speaking, is a very bad place to be. On the show today, from the river to the sea, is, according to two of our five leading newspapers, a call for peace. But first, David Leonhardt of the New York Times was here yesterday to discuss his new book, Ours Was the Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream. Today, he is back to talk about the roles that individual presidents have played in shaping our personal economic circumstances. David Leonhardt, part two, up next. And we're back with David Leonhardt. He is the author of Ours Was the Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream. And I started by asking him, in contrast to the major message of Republicans being the party of racism and Democrats being the party of racial justice, what's the actual facts and finding on the ground? There was, and he talks about this in his book and in our conversation, there was a major study that showed Latinos defecting massively towards Republicans, especially on the border counties of Texas, Latinos whose lives were very much affected by immigration, showing their preferences with their votes, thus undercutting the premise that maybe Republicans are irredeemably racist on the question of the lives of Latinos. However, this is what I began asking Leonhardt. It does seem to me that what Democrats do faced with those facts, that there is a defection of voters that they need on the very issues that they think they're very good in, what we usually see is an addressing of the cosmetic concerns. So John Fetterman wears a hoodie, and Sherrod Brown, in his gravelly tones, talks about the unions. And I believe both of those gentlemen are earnest, but those are the differences and the outreach that comes to mind, not an actual accounting for where the voters are, which is to say a different place from where the Democratic Party is. Here's what Leonhardt says about that.
I think that's fair. I also think the superficial is okay when it's paired with other changes. So one of the other characters in my book, who surely all of my readers have heard of, but I don't think they fully understand his importance, is Robert F. Kennedy, senior, not junior. And
very, very important.
Yes.
Senior, yes.
And when he ran for president in 1968, and let me start by saying, even if he had survived, he might not have won. I'm not saying the world would be totally different if he hadn't been assassinated. I'm just saying, look at how he ran for president. He ran for president as someone who was an unapologetic defender of civil rights, who was the most popular white politician in Black America, who was in favor of very progressive economic policies, and yet who talked about a bunch of issues in ways that were so conservative that publications like my own employer, the New York Times, wrote articles saying, what the heck's going on with this conservative Bobby Kennedy? Mm-hmm. And I think what he was doing was he was respecting the moderate and, yes, sometimes conservative views of large numbers of Americans. When he talked about the Vietnam War, he said it's been a disaster, but he also criticized the student deferments that basically allowed rich kids to stay out of the war while poor kids fought. He honored the service of people who did go to Vietnam. Other Democrats in 1968 claimed crime wasn't really rising, that it was all just an invention of conservatives and racists. Yeah. Well, crime really was rising in the 1960s. And both white and black people, the population that was Latino or Asian at the time was very small, both white and black people were really concerned about it. And Bobby Kennedy used the phrase law and order because right. he said, if we don't, the racists will and we'll lose.
And liberal publications at the time would run many articles saying, well, if you compare crime rates to some earlier time, it's actually not so bad, which is exactly what's going on
today.
In 2020 to 2023.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. No, when I was researching the stuff from the 60s, I had these moments. I guess they're flash forward moments, not flash. That's, I mean, your point there, Mike, is dead on, right? Which is you had a bunch of people, typically on the political left, who in like 2020 and 2021 weren't talking about the fact that crime spiked. And now that it's fallen a little bit from its 2020 highs.
But crime is down.
Right? Yeah. It's like,
but
well,
from where? From where? From the 7% from last year or the up 30% from 3 years ago?
Yeah. And in the 60s, you had The Nation and The New Republic run headlines about the crime wave in which they used quote marks to make clear that they thought it was bogus. It wasn't bogus.
That would be a lack of scare quote.
Yes.
How we call that. Yeah.
It wasn't bogus. It was real. It was clearly real at the time. And so to me, and the reason I bring up Bobby Kennedy is in addition to talking about crime in ways that spoke to voters' concerns and doing these policy changes, he also changed his haircut so that instead of looking like one of these hippie long hairs, he cut his hair shorter. And so the idea that John Fetterman would wear shorts or Sherrod Brown wouldn't get too dressed up, I actually think these small superficial parts of politics are real. Many voters don't make decisions by reading white papers, but you have to pair them with actual respect of voters' attitudes and their views rather than condescendingly say to them, no, 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 you're wrong on all these issues. And let me explain how our positions on economics are more in your interest. And if you don't vote for us, you're obviously either ignorant or hateful. That is not good politics.
Did Bobby Kennedy, if you asked him, did he feel hemmed in? Do you think he felt sort of crushed by the institutions of the progressive scene at the time, such that he would mark himself as an apostate by taking these stances? I mean, he was essentially royalty, so he had a lot more leeway than an average politician trying to earn the good graces of the party apparatus. But I see that as a difference from today.
I agree. The kind of professional, highly educated, affluent, quite left-wing left is more powerful than it was back then. But, you know,
more powerful and more narrow in a way.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It helps to be a politician who also has a connection to voters beyond policy, right? I mean, Barack Obama got people so excited that Barack Obama was also able to do some of these things where he really went to the middle. I mean, you read what Barack Obama
said. That's
right.
If you have charisma, if you can communicate, you can buy yourself, I called it some leeway, but you could buy yourself some credibility and some grace where maybe you have a position that's slightly off the reservation in terms of ideology, and you don't get crushed for it.
Yes, that is right. Yeah. I still think it's important to remember that what Bobby Kennedy did in 1968, there was a lot of pressure telling him to go to the other way. Some of his young aides, who of course came from college campuses, were saying to him directly, whoa, why are you sounding so conservative? You know, what are you doing? And he said that we need to.
Did 400 of those aides put out an open letter, which they didn't sign their names to?
I don't think
so. By the way?
Okay. I do think the 68 campaign is really fascinating. Obviously, I would encourage people to read my account of it in the book. But just generally, I mean, the making of the president, the Theodore White book about 1968, it really is fascinating. And it is, I do think it has a very good claim on being the start of the modern political era and still the era that we're living in. I mean, you have Bobby Kennedy and Ronald Reagan and George Romney running in the primaries. And then ultimately the race comes down to George Wallace, who's Trump before Trump, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. It's just an amazing campaign.
Yeah. And lest the listeners to this show think, OK, Leonhardt has pretty much written off the Republican Party. He hasn't. It's there. If you want a good platform for the Republican Party, it's on page 375 of his book. It's one paragraph, but it's about different senators and prominent Republicans who are endorsing economics in decidedly un-Reagan-esque way. Josh Hawley of Missouri, okay, shamed himself and other manners, urging aggressive enforcement of antitrust policy in the tech sector. Rubio calling for a capitalism of the common good. Mitt Romney, not exactly a member in good standing among other Republicans, proposed a new government program to reduce child poverty. The think tank American Compass publishing ideas similar to that. So the point is, okay, you could take four ideas and that's not a platform. And I don't know that that platform would gain purchase among the typical Republican voter, but I think it's there. I think there is a possibility for each party to more or less generally offer good ideas that also sharpen the ideas of the opposing party. It's not entirely the case that we can only achieve progress through one party because the other we just need to discard in terms of just totally being out of ideas.
Yeah, and let's acknowledge the orange-haired elephant in the room, which is Donald Trump had no coherent policy. Donald Trump said a lot of false and, yes, racist things when he was running for president. But Donald Trump also showed that the Republican voters, the Republican electorate, was not where Paul Ryan and many people long thought it was. Donald Trump ran well to the left of the Republican Party on Medicare, on Social Security, on trade. And so this idea that there are large numbers of Republican voters who are hungry for something that looks like true economic populism, along with deep social conservatism, and that some of those forms of economic populism actually could deliver economic benefits to people. As I say in the book, I think that's less likely to be the party. The Republican Party is the less likely one to be the party that really favors policies that help working class people, in part because of the Supreme Court, which really still is that kind of Paul Ryan, Ronald Reagan Republican Party. But if you were just trying to craft a platform that was socially conservative and economically populist, you could do so. There are signs of it among people in this country. And it's not a very unusual combination in much of the world. I mean, Asian politics are very different than American politics. So using an analogy is always fraught. But large parts of Asia, including China, including Singapore, basically marry this idea of pretty deep social conservatism to a form of economics that isn't simply really low taxes on rich people. It actually includes very meaningful benefits for middle and lower income people. This can be a coherent political philosophy.
So one thing that very much bothers me is if the entire book is about how progress has been eluding us and undergirding that idea is if there is real progress, people will feel it and they'll feel that their lives are improved. I see some counter evidence to that. And since the Great Recession, there has been a lot of economic progress and it hasn't been centered on the non-college educated, but even among the college educated, especially in the last few years, and not just going by this or that perhaps flawed economic statistic, going by, just as you say, well, look at lifespan and look at happiness and look at all these other measures. Things are improving, but I wonder if because of technology or sociology or doomerism or whatever, we have lost the ability to recognize that progress. And how do you actually fight it out in the public sphere and try very hard to get a bill passed that, you know, will take, you'll need to drag it across the finish line. And then you deliver progress to people. And the progress actually happens in ways that are measurable and they should feel. And people just don't feel it. Do you see that going on?
I think I'd half agree and half disagree there. Look, Joe Biden has been a more successful president by a whole bunch of measures than I frankly expected. I mean, he really has gotten more bipartisan legislation signed, including opening semiconductor factories in Ohio and getting Republicans to vote for bills that I just didn't think Republicans would vote for. He's made these big investments in America's future. He has supported labor unions in a way that no president has in decades. And he seems to be getting no credit for it. Right. There isn't this thing of, oh, you know what? All those factories are opening in Ohio and Ohio's in play in 2024. I mean, no one thinks that. No. And so that's the part of your argument that I think is right. And look, I do think probably social media and the feedback loops and polarization and doomerism play a role there. Biden's really old. I know he's only a few years older than Trump, but like he looks more than a few years older than Trump. And so I can't fully tell you exactly why he's not getting the credit on that. The way in which I disagree is I don't think things have actually gotten that much better for most people. I mean, so life expectancy because of COVID is actually down substantially. I mean, the long-term problems with life expectancy among working class Americans haven't reversed. And then we got this shock of COVID. So,
how they calculate life expectancy is if all the conditions were the conditions of that year. So when it's a time of widespread COVID, it's going to depress life expectancy.
But also, the overall trend ain't great.
Yes.
Right. People have died. I just think when you look at health of the last few years, when you look at the fact that, and I think this also plays into why Biden's not getting credit, inflation has been really high. And it's not mostly Joe Biden's fault. Inflation's also been really high in other countries. But I get why people are angry. And when you look at real income, it's fallen in the last year or two because inflation has just been so, so high. And so I agree with you that I have some concerns that certain parts of the feedback loop of the American economy and American politics are either broken or different. But I don't think we'll have really a good test of it that until we get to a point where life is actually better for most Americans than it has been over the last 2 or 3 years. Because okay. I don't think most Americans, when you look at the condition of downtowns and you look at crime and you look at inflation-adjusted income and life expectancy, I don't think things are great.
So last question is, so many of the people in your book are change makers. I detected this, that there was a strain among them that even if they were getting their heads beaten up by Pinkertons, they were optimistic. Do you think the change makers of the past were more optimistic and hopeful than the current change makers of the present?
I hope not. I think A. Philip Randolph might be my favorite figure in the whole book. He spent more than a decade trying to form the first major labor union for Black Americans and just failed and failed and failed, but never stopped trying to push the boulder up the hill and finally succeeded. And when I think about the people who set out to win these raises at the UAW, despite years of losses and frankly corrupt union leadership before the current leadership, I think there's a lot of optimism built into that. When I think about the people who set out to start this movement to raise the minimum wage, even in red states, when I think about the people, many of them in the disability rights community, who said, I know Donald Trump has the votes, but I think we can stop him from repealing Obamacare. So I still do think there are optimistic people, and I still do think for all of the concerns we have, I think there is a demonstrated history, including in recent years, whether it's the minimum wage or Obamacare or marriage equality, which is an incredible victory that came much more quickly than people thought. I still think that the American political system has the capability to make our society and economy work better. I'm not predicting that will happen. But I am confident that we have the tools to make it happen, and it has the potential to happen.
Yeah. I think some of those accomplishments were in 2010, 2012, 2014. It's been a while. But anyway, let's not end on cynicism. Let's end with praise for David Leonhardt, senior writer for The New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author now of Ours Was the Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream. David, thank you so much.
Mike, thanks for this great conversation.
And now the spiel. I read an LA Times story titled, "A Jewish professor at USC confronted pro-Palestinian students. He's now barred from campus. Concerns Professor John Strauss, economics. Went past a group of pro-Palestinian students staging a walkout. One yelled, 'Professor Strauss, shame on you.' He wheels around and says, 'No shame on you. Hamas are murderers. That's all they are. Everyone should be killed. And I hope they all are killed.' Harsh, but perhaps fair. From there, all hell, well, the campus version of hell breaks loose. But it's all on tape, those words I read to you. That's what he said. And once it became clear that's what he said, all the people saying that he said something else have been proved wrong. Still, the LA Times thinks to frame the story as, but at a fundamental level, the episode is also a debate over what exactly transpired. Except it's not a debate. I credit the LA Times for informing me of this. There's really no ambiguity. He said, quote, it's on tape. Hamas are murderers. That's all they are. Everyone should be killed, and I hope they all are killed. Except a bunch of people edited out a bunch of words other than, I hope they all are killed. And then online said he was talking about all Palestinians. Some people online, including one Instagram post with millions of users, said he was talking about the students that Strauss teaches. Quote, one Instagram post shared to millions of users claimed falsely that Strauss told the students, I hope you get killed. Again, I know all this from the LA Times, which was very good at conveying facts, but has a weird allergy to conclusions. There is no debate over what was said. We actually have the facts, even if a lot of online users don't. To once more quote the LA Times, but as the clip circulated online, it was at times trimmed to a few seconds of Strauss uttering, everyone should be killed. The LA Times then gets into a side discussion of if this constitutes doctoring the clip, doesn't matter, irrelevant semantics. He said Hamas should be killed. He was inaccurately depicted as saying Palestinians should be killed. People with millions of followers misdescribed his comments. Some were intentionally lying. And also, LA Times provided this. USC's Muslim Student Union issued a statement saying that Strauss was, quote, repeatedly calling for the murder of the entirety of Palestine and expressing, quote, a desire for the death of those supporting Palestine. That's what we would call not true. So Strauss is placed on administrative leave. He's barred from campus. He's barred from teaching undergrads. But within days, more and more of what really happened came to light. He said, kill Hamas, not kill Palestinians, not kill the USC Trojans. And he got most of his suspensions reversed, though he still is barred from campus. You heard that in the headline. It's all interesting. I guess you might find it just humdrum campus insanity. But here's the part that grabbed my attention. It was tangential to all this. There was one paragraph about the campus protesters in the first place, and it said, the demonstration was part of a national shut it down for Palestine action and included a student walkout from class, a march through campus, and a rally where some students chanted, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. A phrase that is viewed as either a call for Palestinians to have equality or a call for the destruction of Israel, depending on the listener. Oh, so just another ear of the behearer type subjective debate. And I guess it is. I can't prove that from the river to the sea means to everyone saying it. Some people just like chanting things that rhyme. I am sure some of the chanters have never really thought about it. They are the true innocents in all of this. I also know that Rashida Tlaib, when criticized by saying it, even from very left-leaning Democratic colleagues like Jamie Raskin, she backtracked. She went online and she said that from the river to the sea is, quote, a call for freedom, human rights, and peaceful coexistence, not death, destruction, or hate. I cannot prove she knows full well what it means and knows full well how every Jewish Israeli or Jewish American who cares hears it. But maybe she believes her clarification. Maybe Rashida Tlaib, a federal legislator with the power of the purse, the power to fund Israel, a lifelong Palestinian activist, has never once contemplated the implication of the inhabitants of the land between the river and the sea, the land currently called Israel, becoming a Palestinian state. Not accommodating a Palestinian state, sort of a two-state solution, but that land becoming Palestine. What might that mean? I could cite the ADL, the American Jewish Committee, U.S. Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, Ambassador Deborah Lipstadt, calling from the river to the sea, anti-Semitic, or in Lipstadt's case, referring to it as hatred that only makes peace harder to achieve. Because then that would be a discussion of the real meaning of words, and of course, words can have different meanings depending on the intention of the speaker, and we all must take into account the intention of the speaker. Except you may remember, we were told, as an act of progress in 2020, that we should not take into account the intention of the speaker. The intention of the speaker was actively being discredited. I have in front of me an online training manual, a slide, anti-racism, intent versus impact, a tool in anti-racist education. Intent centers the feelings of white people. Impact centers the feeling of people of color, POC. Then we have Welcome's anti-racist principle. Welcome is the fourth largest charitable foundation in the world. They, too, put out a toolkit. And what do they say? Only outcomes, not intent, demonstrate whether actions and policies are racist. So there is a rebuke of some people say it's peaceful. Here's the UNC School of Public Health's guideline for anti-racist discussion. They write, if a peer is hurt by something you said or did, your intention is no longer the focus. The impact of your words or actions is more important. I could read 100 more assertions that intent doesn't matter. The hurt it causes should. Except when it comes to the Jews or Israel's. And then, wait, hold on, I think there's something else somewhere else in the toolkit about colonizers, and that takes precedence. It is cognitively taxing to live in a time when microaggressions are elevated as a cause to guard against, that we should all have quite a considerable fear of giving offense. But the explicit aggression of a sentiment that says, get the Jews out of Israel, not necessarily via the sword, could be via El Al, but anyway, get them out. Well, that's one, for the first time maybe, where reasonable people can view it quite differently. So I know I could score a point by highlighting the supposed hypocrisy involved in all this, but then I would be hypocritical. You want to know why? I've never believed in a default to impact-only evaluation, even if social justice says that they do. So I am not here to score a point about the hypocrisy of others. And I am not here to assert that the only interpretation of From the River to the Sea is a violent one or an eliminationist one. Okay, then what am I here to assert? It's this. It's that the debate is over and the Rashida Tlaib side has won. From the river to the sea has been made palatable and acceptable in all the spaces this side of a conservative temple. I know the Rashida Tlaib side has won because of what I just quoted in the LA Times. When they write that it is a phrase that is viewed as either a call for Palestinians to have equality or a call for the destruction of Israel, depending on the listener, that decides things. Add to that the Washington Post. They wrote a story, From the River to the Sea, Why a Palestinian Rallying Cry Ignites Dispute. Why does it ignite dispute? The answer as to why it ignites dispute wasn't because the only reasonable inference is the disappearance of Israel as a Jewish state, which presupposes the disappearance of the Jews from the land. No, that wasn't the answer why it ignites dispute. It ignites dispute because people disagree about what it means. And to quote one subhead of this story, to some, it's a call for peace. Quote, it's a call to end the occupation by Israel, says Maha Nasser, an associate professor of Middle Eastern history and Islamic studies at the University of Arizona. And she says, a call for an ability to return, end quote, to areas from which Palestinians fled or were expelled. The Post, though, then goes on to say that the Palestinian right of return is internationally recognized, which is not a lie, but it's more inaccurate than accurate. I guess it may be recognized in the reading of certain UN resolutions that don't have the power to grant the right of return. By the way, the right of return is also a policy that would mean the end of Israel as a Jewish state. But let's not get into the right of return. We have established that two of the nation's five most subscribed to newspapers, which are both bright lights in the liberal firmament, say that From the River to the Sea may not be offensive because some people don't mean it that way. It's also very subjective. And given the imprimatur of these two newspapers and other similar institutions, Everyone uttering it now has an out, an escape for any claim to accountability of what the words actually clearly mean. Because, quote, to some, it's a call for peace. So I'll take that one. Yeah, you're accusing me of saying something insensitive or anti-Semitic? No, no, no. I'm taking that to some, it's a call for peace. And also, if you're within the movement, you could see that I'm winking and nodding, right? The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, those two papers haven't weighed in with as explicit a permission structure as the LA Times and Washington Post, but the New York Times has at other times written stories saying the apparent offense given is not real. I'm thinking of a story from this summer. Kill the Boer song fuels backlash in South Africa and the United States. Right-wing commentators claim that an old apartheid chant is a call to anti-white violence. The word kill being the verb. The word Boer, meaning Dutch farmers. I could see why maybe right-wing commentators would say that. Subhead goes on to say, but historians, and the left-wing politician who embraces it, says it should not be taken literally. Kill the Boer, don't take it literally, says historians. Oh, forget the left-wing politician. Historians, and not just some left-wing historians or historians who disagree with Nelson Mandela's horror at the slogan. Just historians, kill the Boer, okay. From the river to the sea, okay. Now let's check in. Just out of curiosity, humor me here. Let's check in with another slogan that might, just based on the words, seem more anodyne than those two.
I don't think that the people that are posting All Lives Matter should be canceled. I think they should be educated.
Black lives matter. White lives matter. All lives matter.
I read a column on a liberal blog saying that he was using the language of white supremacy. Can you explain why people would be mad at somebody saying all lives matter?
Well, here on Facing Race, we're asking our experts your anonymous questions in a weekly segment we call Frequently Awkward Questions.
Tonight's question from viewers. Why is there so much pushback when someone says all lives matter? Here to answer, Dr. Ibram Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, Dr. Relina Joseph, ethnic studies professor at the University of Washington, and race educator, Dr. Caprice Hollins.
You might not be surprised, if you have even a passing familiarity with the work of those on the panel, that none of them said it is a call for peace. And while All Lives Matter is frequently used as an obnoxious answer to the cry of Black Lives Matter, I looked into it and saw unanimity of opinion on this point. I saw no outlets that shape opinion saying there is ambiguity to the question that all lives matter is an offensive thing. Let's take this New York Times story from June of 2020. Sacramento Kings TV announcer resigns over all lives matter tweet. Subhead Grant Napier used the phrase, which has often been used to dismiss the specific prejudices faced by Black Americans during an exchange with a former Kings player. Or the 2019 Times story about Pete Buttigieg using the phrase 4 years earlier, quote, his use of the phrase all lives matter, which has often carried the connotation of ignoring the specific grievances of Black Americans, has come under scrutiny. So, to summarize, there are some sentiments that might seem all right, but no, they aren't. We have to tell you that. We need to make that clear. All lives matter is in that category. And then there are some phrases that might not seem all right, but they are. Kill the Boers, one. Not kill the Jews. We can agree that not kill the Jews till we can't. That you can't say. But make the Jews go away. Make the Jews give up their land, give up their rights. It's fine to call that peace. That's okay. It doesn't matter that Jewish organizations say it's not okay. That the anti-Semitism experts say it's not okay. That the listeners to it find offense, which is the standard of, I don't know, 45 minutes ago. See, also Believe All Women, also a thing that used to be de facto slogan until it wasn't for one bunch of people, don't know which one. Clearly, From the River to the Sea is about a change in governance, in rights, in freedom, in power. It is not a call for peace. That's not what it is. I am not saying that it is inherently a call to slaughter, but it is not a call for peace. Only now, I guess it is a call for peace. For the record, I think it is acceptable to say any of this, to say all of this. I am all for free speech. I just wish the meaning of the speech weren't obscured. And I especially wish meanings weren't obscured from the institutions we trust as the great purveyors and arbiters of truth. And that's it for today's show. Working late today were Corey Wara, producer of The Gist, and Gist senior producer Joel Patterson. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.